Okay, welcome to the Paul 240 review presentation. I hope that you've all come with questions and are all very excited to hear things which you already know and therefore feel very smug, or open to the fact you might learn new things this evening. So please feel free to ask questions. Keep in mind that if you have a question, then probably someone else has the same question. So be generous in asking questions, and that is a service to your fellow Paul 240 students. Also, it is a service to those who could not make it tonight. So try to make sure that you ask their questions as well so that I can then answer them. All right. So this particular outline is my attempt to divide all of the readings that we have done so far, at least as far as theory goes, into a number of categories. Now, where there's a one-way arrow, it's a thought is descended from, whereas that if there is no arrow, that is to say, it's just a line that connects two things, it is a difference between two different theorists. So, starting way back with Thucydides in 400 BC, ooh, it even highlights. You can see that Hobbes being descended from Thucydides in terms of early classical realist thought, that there are differences with respect to the state of nature between Hobbes and Locke, and then differences with respect to the cause of war between Locke and Hobbes. We have not actually covered Rousseau. This is because the Rousseau reading is about 80 pages and not terribly relevant as far as IR scholars go. Handouts are up front. Late people coming in. But I wanted to include Rousseau on here insofar as Rousseau is important as far as both political liberalism and its history goes, as well as being one of the origins of constructivism, in terms of thinking about the cause of war and conflict in the international system and where those come from, whether it is in some sort of a state of nature or whether, in fact, war and peace themselves are socially constructed. Note, as I mentioned at the beginning of the class, that Hobbes is actually a political liberal, not a realist per se in terms of the political theory tradition. Nonetheless, for the purposes of this graph, I'm going to put him under realism, because that's how realists qualify. From there, you can see the descent to Morgenthau. Obviously, we had the reading Tichtner at the very beginning of class with respect to differences over the principles of political realism. From Morgenthau, we have Waltz. Note on the side, we're moving from classical perspectives to structural or neo-perspectives. I'm going to be going over all these in the actual presentation as well, so you don't need to necessarily follow. I just wanted to explain the relationships on this graph before we got into the main part of it. Waltz differs with Cohen, which is to say, the liberal institutionalist, on the effects of anarchy. Is anarchy, in fact, as constraining as Waltz says it is? Cohen argues it is not. The date which I have here is 1984. The reason it has 1998 in parentheses is that that is what you actually read. But Cohen's classic book, from which the ideas in the 98 reading are drawn from, is from 1984. So you can keep track sort of the historical genealogy of these different theories. Moreover, Wendt differs with Waltz over what the effects of cultures of anarchy are. So, in other words, the Hobbesian, Lockean, and Kantian cultures of anarchy, which Wendt pulled from, although I did not draw lines because that would mess up the nice diagram here. But you can see all of those different strands of thought in Wendt and coming from Rousseau, and that Rousseau argued essentially that these different states of nature are socially constructed, not due to some sort of inherent state of nature. Finally, we have Mearsheimer, who is, of course, an offensive neorealist versus the defensive realism of Waltz and evolved Waltz's theories further. Then we have a number of debates, which I will be going over in the presentation. One is over the conditions of cooperation. So we had Jervis and the security dilemma, conditions under which you would get cooperation of one kind, which is to say not fighting each other, and Oi with a more of a neoliberal institutionalist perspective on conditions of cooperation. We have alliances, whether balancing and bandwagoning, should be considered balancing bandwagon with respect to threat or with respect to interest, with respect to Schweller. Finally, we have Mearsheimer and his differences with Cohen and Barden over liberal institutionalism and what liberal institutions can potentially shape, how they can shape the international system, and then with Wendt over whether constructivist institutions, critical theory, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, we have the democratic piece, with Doyle having the classic liberal perspective and Rosato having the realist perspective on the democratic piece, which is to say that it doesn't actually exist. There are also a number of literature reviews which we read in which authors talked about one or more different concepts, and I wanted to include them on here because they are important, roughly in terms of the column which I think that they might fall in terms of their paradigm. So, of course, we have Waltz 1959, reviewed by Singer in 1960. That's levels of analysis piece. There's the Ellison piece, in which there are three different levels of analysis, but he's, at least the first one's in the realist tradition, and then LeBeau, who is reviewing different types of psychological theories. Baldwin, who's reviewing the neoliberal versus neorealist theories, and then we have Hoppe, who is looking at constructivism, and then Soberg and Carpenter for different types of feminist theories. So what I'm mostly am going to concentrate on is the upper part of this. I'm going to go over Ellison and LeBeau, just because they are uniquely within and of themselves. Most of the theorists here have single perspectives, but as you saw, Ellison and LeBeau are, to at least some extent, debating with themselves. So I'm going to treat them as debates as opposed to individual theorists. All right, questions about this particular genealogical chart? Nope, all good, clear, terrific. Moving on. All right. So what I'm going to go over as far as this part of the review is, I'm going to start with introduction, levels of analysis. I'm going to talk about ologies. That's more for those who are actually interested in the sort of scientific philosophical underpinnings of the different theories. I briefly mentioned them in class. I wanted to just briefly mention them here as well. This is your bonus content for the evening for showing up and being here on time, more or less. I'll then be going over... I'll then be accidentally advancing things, apparently. All right, that's better. All right, then be going over four paradigms, realism, liberalism, constructivism, and feminism, in their various variants, as we have seen them so far in class. And then be going over five debates. I mentioned the first three, conditions for cooperation, balancing and bandwagoning, and a democratic peace. Our debates between theorists and organizations in psychology are theorists who are debating with themselves to a certain extent. Okay. Start with the three levels of analysis. So, by now, hopefully all of you will be able to recite these from heart, but I did want to go over them at least briefly to make sure that these were absolutely clear and give you examples, both sort of a general example about the types of different types of theoretical statements which are made at these different levels of analysis. All right. Starting with the first level individual, this, of course, are Singer and Waltz in the upper right-hand corner for reference. The first level, the individual level, we haven't seen a whole lot of theories in this class about it, but it is important nonetheless in terms of effects that it can potentially have on international relations. So statements that generally fall under the individual level of analysis have to do with either general, very, very, very general statements about the nature of man. Man seeks power or men seek power. Of course, this is long before any feminist critiques came about, so man seeks power and men seek power was pretty natural to say. You can also tell that a statement's at the individual level of analysis when it's talking about individual leaders. So in my example here, George Bush seeks power. You can tell that I wrote this initial presentation a few years ago. Second level, state level, which we can divide into the country level of analysis and the organizational level of analysis. Country level of analysis, again, similar to the individual level of analysis, you can talk about statements that are theories at the country level is something like the nature of certain states. You can say democracies are less warlike. Now keep in mind that is not the actual democratic peace hypothesis, which requires that democracies do not fight each other. Most of the empirical findings are that democracies do in fact fight other countries just as often as any other type of country. So, then again, as with the first individual level, there are also statements which one can make about individual states, So we can move up from the individual level, from George Bush seeks power, to the United States seeks power. Or if you prefer, you can go with Nicolas Sarkozy in France, or whatever your particular inclinations are for making statements about individual countries. You can also have the organization level, which we primarily see, of course, in Allison. So here you can say something about nature of organizations, generally speaking. So Allison's organizational process model, for example, says that standard operating procedures lead to errors and problems. But then, again, as with the other levels of analysis so far, you can also make statements about individual organizations, such as the Department of Defense seeks power. All right. Clear? Good? Yes. Okay, I'm going to take this as the complete comprehension look. All right, moving up, third level, the state system. You can divide into the interaction and structural levels. At the interaction level, statements are made about interactions among units, such as democracies don't attack each other. They could also be relational arguments, which is to say that it specifies a particular type of relation between a group of countries. Note the differences between them, and that some of them are relations between units that are at a slightly lower level in the sense that it comes from the interaction between like types of units. And then there's the relational arguments. By the way, I think I posted, there was a recent article in which it argued that human rights abusers don't conflict as much. Is that, no? Could I, maybe that's just in my head that I posted that. In any case, there are other statements which can be made about interactions among like units other than the simple democracies don't attack each other. Relational arguments have to do with collective relations between countries and which don't actually go back down into the unit level, so allies don't attack each other, or countries that have special relationships don't attack each other. Then we have the structural level, where we're looking at the distributions of certain types of characteristics across the entire state system. Okay, so we've seen in this class, we've seen distributions of power, that's Waltz. Distributions of threat, that's Walt. And distributions of interests, as in Schweller. So this allows you to make statements about certain types of distributions and the implications of those distributions. So in the case of the distribution of power, one statement which Waltz makes is that bipolar is more stable than multipolar. Okay. And as I noted today, that no one has ever made any statements so far in the class about what unipolarity looks like. You can also make positional arguments with respect to structure. So whatever your position is vis-a-vis the rest of the system. So, for example, hegemons seek power. Now, there's almost no one who makes that argument in international relations, but it was one of the easiest ones I could think of. So, Mearsheimer, in fact, generally seems to argue that it's only once you're a hegemon that you sort of quiet down and become a status quo state. All right. The one thing I do want to mention is that you can apply structural and interaction theories, apply unit-level theories, that is to say things about characteristics of individual units, to things other than international relations. Right, so you can think about groups of individuals, groups of organizations, how they act vis-a-vis each other structurally. If you look at some sort of a distribution of something across them, you think about them positionally vis-a-vis each other, or functionally, how they differ from each other. So these general types of theories can occur at different levels. You can still have a structural theory within an individual state, but that structural theory is going to look different in part because you're no longer under the constraints of anarchy. Good? Good. All right. Paradigms. No visual punters here? There we go. Okay. All right, as I have drawn up on the board more than a few times, there are a number of different ways which one can distinguish not only between different paradigms. I want to make an additional point here about why we think about paradigms and how different people in international relations think about paradigms. We've been talking about paradigms in a number of different ways and how they can relate to each other. So let me start with that. So these different paradigms can be seen as competing perspectives on the world. They can be making the argument that the world is like this or the world is like that. The world is full of conflict. The world is full of cooperation. The world is full of dichotomies which are termed gendered male and female, where the male one is considered to be positive, the female one is not. The world is full of anarchy, of a culture of anarchy which causes conflict. They can also be seen in a more complementary way. Mussini is explaining different phenomena. Realists talk about war, liberals talk about cooperation, constructivists talk about social constructs of any kind, feminists talk about gendered things. Of course, one of the arguments of critical theory is that, in fact, and constructivism in particular, is that they're not explaining different phenomena, that all phenomena are socially constructed or gendered or what have you. So it's mostly the realists and liberals that have decided that they can, that they are examining different types of phenomena in the world, and they very neatly divided up the world in between conflict and cooperation. You do this, I'll do that. Another way of looking about this is a division of labor between determining interests and determining outcomes. So the constructivists, critical theorists, do not buy any of this, of course. They just point out that all these other paradigms are just out to get them and are just having these structures of power by attempting to have these, go with these other types of reasoning. Is that constructivism, for example, determines interests by thinking about identities, which identities are salient. Where do they appear? How do they constrict or enable, say, to have certain identities and certain interests? Once you know what the interests are of whatever your units are, whether it's people or organizations or states, then you use realist and liberal paradigms in order to determine outcomes. So once you know that the identities of these particular people are prisoners and that they are in cells, you can then use game theory through the prisoner dilemma in order to try to figure out what they're going to do as a result of it. And the final way of thinking about these things, I mean, there are virtually an infinite number of ways of thinking about these things, but one which I wanted to mention, that you can also see these as empirical bets on the frequency of international phenomena. That is to say that constructivists are going to argue that the types of phenomena which you're going to see is that we should not expect to see stasis in the international system. We should not expect to see social constructs and cultures of anarchy that are static and fixed. You should not, that liberals will argue that that we will not be seeing as much conflict as we had in the past. We're actually going to be seeing a lot more cooperation. That realists are going to say, actually, the world's going to look exactly like it always has. We're going to see lots of conflict between these different units, regardless of what the units look like. Empires, city-states, states, doesn't matter. They're going to conflict with each other. So there's a variety. You can think about these ways any way you like. So when you write your papers, when you talk in class, it doesn't matter which of these that you are believing. I do want you to be able to explain things from the different paradigms, even if you don't believe them yourselves, though. All right, and then of course we have the 2x2 here, which I like to use in order to think about the differences between them. This is to say one axis can power be overcome, the other one being our idea is important, where of course the realists say that power cannot be overcome and ideas are not important. Critical theory says power cannot be overcome, but ideas are important. In fact, ideas are power. The liberals argue that power can be overcome, but ideas aren't important. It's all about stuff. And that constructivists, with the sort of shiny, happy norms holding hands, are in the power can be overcome through the power of ideas. All right. Questions about paradigms? Yeah?
You were just talking about a division of labor between different things. I don't understand
what
you mean by that.
Right. So, suppose that... I mean, let me just try to give you like a couple of examples of how these theories might work together. So Schweller, for example, posits that there's some sort of distribution of interest, that there are some lions, some lambs, some wolves, and some jackals in the international system. He doesn't actually specify how a state ends up being one of these things or another. So you could argue that you could have a division of labor between his version of realism and constructivism. If constructivists could go out and specify or have some way of thinking about how do you know when a state is an X or a Y or a Z, or when do they see themselves as a lion or a jackal or a lamb or what have you? These theories would be outside of Schweller's theory of identity, but would be compatible with it. Right? It's not an actual contradiction between them. Now, there are some people who argue that certain types of theories are more or less compatible with each other. So, Some people say that Waltzian realism and Wendtian constructivism are compatible with each other, at least to a certain extent, in that Wendt says that, well, Waltz is correct, but he's just got an additional assumption in there, and that Wendt is simply exploring different types of assumptions. So that would be another potential, you know, division of labor between them. As I mentioned, especially towards the last few weeks, especially with World War I, there's lots of things on perceptions, right? That it's not the realist underlying realist variables all the time, but it's the perceptions of those variables. Constructivists might be able to tell us more about why certain people or with certain identities, certain countries with certain identities would perceive things in one way or another. And then given those perceptions, the realists say, okay, given some distribution of perceptions or ideas, you're going to see more or less war in the international system. So if the offense-defense balance is perceived to be in favor of the offense, then you're going to see more war. Then you have, say, Wilcox's account of feminism, which explains why it is that you have a cult of the offensive, right? Some sort of the conditions under which you see that. Is that good? All right. Yeah. Sure. So the realists say everything's going to look like it has been in the past. The liberals say that there's going to be more cooperation in the future. We're going to have more institutions. They'll become more solid and more useful and will affect international politics. The constructivists will say that norms are going to evolve over time in the international system. They're not going to stay static. Wendt, for example, argues that one day there will be a world state, right, and that these norms of sovereignty will corrode over time. And critical theorists probably just think the world is going to continue being dominated by power, but it will. Exactly who's dominating and what particular linguistic or discourses they're using to dominate may change over time. Although maybe many feminist theorists may argue that we will just continue to have these gender dichotomies, they just may become more subtle. Other stuff? Alrighty. Ologies. So, as you saw probably in the reading specifically for today, that there are more or less implicit or explicit standards which international relations theorists use in order to try to adjudicate between theories. One of them is parsimony, which they more or less, well, I think they're abusing Occam's razor somewhat, but I'm not going to worry too much about it for the purposes here. If you'd like to know more about philosophy of science, I believe that is taught in history and philosophy and other places. So, very briefly, oh, this is Occam, by the way. If you're wondering who the picture is, who came up with the razor. So, different theories make, so here's the rough guide, okay? Ontology is what is. Basically, think of it as your base set of assumptions, what the things that exist out there in the world which vary over time. John, there's some handouts up front. This tends to vary both by and within paradigms. So some paradigms, right, so within realism, there's different types of realisms which vary on their ontology. So for classical realists, right, the state is important, but the state is permeable. It is not a black box. It's not an object to be taken out of the analysis. Whereas the structural realist, the state is a black box. We're going to hide everything within it. We're going to take it's the structure of the international system is the thing which is important, and not individual leaders or democracies or what have you, as you see with classical realism. Epistemology, I mean, and there can even be agreement about ontologies across paradigms. So Wendt agrees on a number of things about what is in the international system with Mearsham, right? He agrees that structural level theorizing, he agrees that states are the main units which we should be concerned with. He doesn't agree that anarchy is as constraining as Mearsham thinks it is. Epistemology is to how we know. That is, how do we go out and observe the world and come up with theories about that world and then apply them from case to case? Most of the paradigms we've gone over, except for critical theory, are loosely post-positivistic. Post is in parentheses because people will refer to it as positivistic. It's just post meaning just coming after, not a radical denunciation of. So it essentially is this idea that we have theories, we have this standard which is falsification, that is to say, theories need to make arguments or present things that if we found them to be false, that we would believe that theory less. There's no way to actually prove a theory is true, because you never know that you conducted an exhaustive search for all the possible examples of something out there. But the more examples you look at, the more consistent it is, the more faith you have in the theory. The more examples that you find which falsify the theory, which is to say evidence against the theory, the less you're likely to believe it. That's a roughly positivistic perspective on epistemology, how we know. All of them tend to agree that we have some sort of direct access to the world. Some of them think it's a little clouded in some way, but we can say things about it. If you remember back from Tichner, she said that we could have more of a feminist epistemology in which we admit that we are not, in fact, separate from the world, that all of our instruments in social science, which we use to observe things, are already tainted, right? They're already, we look at things with masculine or feminine lenses or what have you. But as long as we are reflexive about that, that we are not doing too much damage. We can say things about the world out there, even though the world itself is socially constructed. And even though our lenses are flawed, we can, in fact, deduce things. It's not the case for all critical theory. Methodology is just how do we go about doing it. So this varies immensely by paradigm for realism and liberalism. Use game theory, sometimes statistics. Constructivists tend to do much more process tracing or focus comparison, where you look at a couple of cases very carefully and then compare them to each other. All of these do tend to be fairly tightly tied together. That is to say, they're usually consistent across things. It's important that the one of the things which is important about this is that you do not start making assumptions in one domain and then assume that they are true in other ones. So, for example, just because you need to keep in mind, if you're going to be take a structural realist perspective, that just because they assume that states are the primary actors does not mean that it is actually true that states are the primary actors in international politics. Do not make an assumption which you make for the purposes of your trying to come up with a theory about the world. Do not make the mistake of assuming that because you have assumed it and it proves some things that it therefore your assumption therefore is true. Your assumption is simply useful. All right. Okay. Let's talk about realism. So, as I've mentioned before, and as was my justification for reading it, by the way, for each one of these theories, I'm going to go over some sort of premises, some analysis, if they do have analysis. Thucydides really doesn't have an analysis. We're more or less trying to read it out of the text, what he's thinking in terms of realism, same thing with Hobbes. And then there's some prescriptions, which some theories offer. Not all theories offer very consistent or very obvious prescriptions. Sometimes you sort of have to tease them out a bit. That's what I'm going to do for most of these theories here. So for realism, which we have Thucydides, lovely bust in Hobbes. So for Thucydides, right, the basic premise is that justice only exists between equals. And so the prescription for how the world does and should work is that the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must. Now this is the surface lesson which realists take from Thucydides. Other people take entirely different lessons from Thucydides, of course. But this is the realist lesson which they then apply to their own realist thinking and saying, oh, you know, we're all descended from Thucydides and his tough thinking about international politics. So, moving from there to Hobbes, right? Hobbes starts the number of premises and are equal. Equality leads to diffidence, which along with competition and glory lead to war, with war, of course, being a state, not in which war is constantly happening, but in which conflict can constantly break out at any point. The prescriptions which Hobbes has, of course, are to submit to a central authority, the Leviathan, and that without that central authority, man is in a state of war. Again, not that there's conflict constantly, but that there is no peace. All right, so, and we zoom forward to classical realism with Morgenthau. He starts with the premises, some basic premises, some of which are epistemological assumptions, right? That the world is separate, it's objective, and it's relatively constant. Right? So you'll find in some of these assumptions that some of these are ontological assumptions, some of them are epistemological assumptions, some of them are methodological. Don't worry too much about trying to nicely divide what type of assumption each one is, but I want you to keep it sort of in the back of your mind that different people have different types of assumptions which they are making for the purposes of trying to explain their theories. All right. And he is probably, I'm not going over all of his political principles, I'm just going over the ones that are most directly relevant in terms of the genealogy of realism and in terms of the things which you're going to be or have been writing in your papers. Argues that the national interest is and should be defined as power. Now, he has analyses at all three levels of analysis. We mostly focused on the first level of analysis, which then, of course, causes the second level of analysis. First one being that man desires power, defined as the control of man over man, as both a means and an end. The second level, he makes some snide remarks or side remarks about how some states are better than others at balancing. In particular, democracies are much too slow. They are held back by having to please the public. And he even has a little bit at the third level. It says that you should consider the interests of others. Or that you shouldn't unnecessarily go around provoking other states. Right? Defining your national interests as power, you need to just figure out what their interests are, and sometimes they aren't always going to be incompatible. So, prescriptions, minimize your risks, maximize the benefits, and balance, balance, balance. Ça va? All right. First variant of structural realism. Hank Waltz. All right, so Waltz has a number of premises. The premises are his assumptions about the structure of the international system. First, he has a three-part definition of structure. The first one is that the ordering principle, that is to say, any system can be defined by three principles. Which isn't to say that differentiates between all possible systems, but for the purposes of the systems which he's looking at, these are his premises. So first, the ordering principle, anarchy versus hierarchy. Anarchy being the lack of central control, hierarchy being having a central control. The characters of the units. So for him, states are treated as functionally identical, rational, and seek survival. Functionally identical does not mean equally competent. It means that they all try to do the same things. All states look the same, more or less. They have similar governmental functions. They try to maintain their sovereignty. They relate to other states in similar ways. It's contrasted with hierarchy. In hierarchy, you have a division of labor, in which some groups or units do some things, other units do other things. Okay. But in the international system, you have the units are functionally identical. The third part of his definition of structure has to do with the distribution of capabilities. He's looking at the material distribution of capabilities. His analysis, at least in this text, is exclusively third level. He argues that states will balance against each other. They'll be concerned with relative power gains, right? Not absolute gains, as the neoliberals do, and that bipolar systems will be more stable than multipolar ones. Prescriptions is that states try to maintain the status quo. He's a defensive realist. That means you don't try to maximize your power, you just try to get enough power in order to ensure your own survival. And that by just trying to get enough power, you will not piss off other states, because if you do that, then they will balance against you. Yeah.
For the third level of analysis, is he just talking about power structure and interaction? Like, he wouldn't be talking about the threat.
Right, so waltz is almost exclusively structural. Right, he doesn't talk about interaction. He doesn't really go down to the interaction level. And for him, it's just about power. He doesn't have these sort of more nuanced versions, threat, in which we add a lot of other things on top of power in order to think about threats. Or interests as Schweller. Yeah. Other question about Waltz? Alrighty. Structural Realism 2, Mearsheimer. Hopefully you have all, this has all been already kind of in your heads. He has five assumptions: anarchy, active offense, intentions are uncertain of other states, concerned with their own survival, and that they have a utilitarian rationality. His analysis, like Waltz's, is all at the third level. It's all structural. He doesn't have any interaction type of arguments. Three results: fear, self-help, and power maximization. Power maximization here, of course, contrasts with earlier classical realism, Morgenthau. Morgenthau states to maximize power, but that was both as a means and an end. For Mearsheimer, maximizing power is a means to an end, where the end is simply survival, like Waltz. But due to the additional assumptions she makes about effective offense and uncertainty of intentions, instead of getting the defensive realist world of satisfying power, just getting enough, you end up maximizing power instead. So prescriptions, well, all states should try to maximize power, and all states will be revisionists except for the hegemon. This is offensive realism. Not because he actually advocates for states being offensive, trying to invade other states, but that states are all revisionist. All right, so in defensive realism, they're all status quo. Offensive realism, they're all revisionist, unless you're the hegemon, in which case you can be status quo, because you like being the hegemon. Questions about Mearsheimer? The extension that I mentioned today is not part of what we read, but is part of his book, in which he further differentiates not just between bipolar and multipolar systems, but unbalanced and balanced ones. Right, so that's just for your reference. If you're interested in that, you can check his book out of the library, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. Yeah, Spencer.
All right, so for the self-help, no subordination of interest, that means that because self-help, there's no authority to come prying to, so you cannot, to use Croquet's analogy, You can't settle for second best because then you'll get
this walk over without anyone. Yep. And because you never know how much power is enough to satisfy your own survival.
And power is a means to the end.
Right. Power is a means to the end. The end is survival. You can only ensure survival by becoming the hegemon. Which is why unstable... which is why you have these multipolar systems where someone's slightly ahead is particularly unstable, because that state has the chance to become the hegemon and is likely to go for it. Yeah.
Couldn't you say it was the opposite theory that a means and an end?
Classical realism, Morgenthau, right? There's a will to power. You know, men want power, and because men want power, states want power. So it's both a means and an end. You want power, and why do you want power? You want power because you want power. It's a little circular. That's all right. Those he had to leave some problems for the neo-realist to try to solve later. Other stuff? Yep, okay. Liberalism. All right, so as I mentioned earlier, Hobbes is actually a liberal, like Locke and Kant, because all of them are concerned with getting and keeping their stuff, ultimately. So the liberals also draw upon Hobbes as one of the philosophical origins. So, Hobbes, writing in 1651, argued that the state of nature is war, prescription is central authority, which leads to commerce and internal peace. Locke, by contrast, argued that the state of nature is peace, but that violations cause war. That is sort of vigilante justice, but in the end, you have the same kind of prescription, which is come up with some kind of a central authority. Although the central authority, instead of stopping war, essentially stops the sort of retribution cycle which goes back and forth between the criminals and the vigilantes who try to come after them. Then we have Kant, who's responding to both of them, but drawing his state of nature in terms of war directly from Hobbes. Argue that nations were the natural units in the system. So instead of having, so that the solution to war in the international system is not simply have a single central authority, but instead have this community of nations that comes together, as those are the natural units. Prescriptions, you have a republican constitutions, which is to say the rule of law, not republican in terms of capital R Republican in the U.S. That's a very different kind of Republican. Interstate trade, right? Trade is helpful. And international organizations, this community of nations. There's also, of course, his very, very long laundry list of all the most particular things, but this is known in international relations theory as the Kantian triad. Right, as long as you have all three of these things, then you're going to end up with peace, or at least less war. Yeah, Spencer?
So I recall reading on Kant that he said he opposed democracy, though, with favored republicanism. What was his rationale for that?
Nope, got nothing. All right. Essentially, he liked republican, the rule of law, separation between executive and legislature. But he argued that democracy essentially is essentially despotic. That when you have it's this very sort of odd argument where the fewer people who are in power, the better they could represent everyone equally. Right, the idea is that if you have a single person, then they can sort of look out and see everyone's interests and be like, I'm going to act in everyone's interests. Or if you have a bunch of individuals in a democracy, then they're only going to look after their own individual interests and not some sort of collective interest. It's a kind of a weird argument as far as you know, modern political theory goes. I mean, although, you know, it does clearly relate to some arguments about how democracy leads to despotism, you know, the tyranny of the majority, et cetera, Federalist Papers. You read that at some point? High school? Sometime? Yeah. What? Where is it taught here? Tipalti 10, I hope? Gronke's course?
No, Morrow's course.
Morrow's course? Okay. All right, so it's still sitting in political theory. That's good to know. All right. Any other questions? Classical liberals? The origins of liberals. We still have the classical liberal, who is Doyle. All right. So Doyle has a formulation of classical liberalism. Classical liberalism, like classical realism, does not shy from cracking open the state and looking at basic premises from which can conclude things about the international system itself. So premises of liberalism include treating others as ethical objects, freedom of representation, participation, and then the liberal argument, as far, the classical liberal argument, is that these internal norms can then be applied to the external international system as well. So there are four institutions which make up classical liberalism: juridical equality, representative government, private property rights, and the economy is supposed to be shaped by supply and demand. He does say that there are different variants, laissez-faire and socialist democracy, but that's sort of unimportant for his purposes, in that they both have all four of these institutions. So he argues that by sort of externalizing these norms, that liberal states will be able to be at peace. At the first level, he says, well, there might be a cause here in that you might have democratic peace through regular rotation of office, and that if individuals who have pissed each other off, if they regularly rotate out of office, that this will eliminate personal rivalries. He mentioned it, so I'm mentioning it here. You can buy it if you like or not. Second level, that there's this combination, which he draws from Kant, right, that individuals who rule the polity bear the cost of wars, states will act more rationally, and commerce and trade will pacify states, give them an interest in not fighting each other. And at the third level of analysis, that international law, the acceptance of domestic law, is a norm which then becomes externalized and used in the international system as well, that they will submit to the rule of law rather than simply using power in order to dominate each other. All right, so prescriptions, promote trade, democratization, and international organizations. Question about classical liberalism? Well, he's using this to try to explain the democratic piece, right? But we're going to get we're going to circle back around to that later when we get to the debates as well. Spencer?
International law here.
Yeah.
Just talking about how there is a rule of international law, or should be.
That states should submit themselves to the rule of international law, and that the more democratic and liberal states are, the more they will do that. So it's different from there being a sovereign authority in that states have to, in fact, voluntarily, to a certain extent, submit themselves to punishment and have to respect the bodies that that adjudicate because there is no enforcement. Right? In the domestic system, the rule of law is backed up by the use of force, or at least the threat of force. But in the international system, there's no single sovereign authority which is going to punish states. States have to punish each other voluntarily with the rulings of the rule of law. So it becomes a lot more difficult. Okay, so this isn't to say that there aren't formal aspects to international law. In fact, there's a lot of formal aspects to international law, but that there's more, that there's a compliance problem.
When you say there's no authority to punish states, so they have to punish each other, does that mean like a state punishes itself, or like another state will call it out?
Well, sometimes it varies. Sometimes states will, you know, if they lose a ruling, they'll comply with it.
Okay.
There are certain famous environmental lawsuits having to do with, say, the dolphin tuna one is sort of the most obvious one in that. The United States started, and many of them are trade-related, which you can see the clearest application in compliance with international law. So the United States wanted to save dolphins from being killed along with the tuna. And so they mandated that a particular type of device be put on ships in order to stop this from happening, and that banned the sale of dolphin unsafe tuna. Well, there was sued in that one of the things about the World Trade Organization is that you cannot differentiate how a product is made. You may not discriminate on that basis. At least countries can. Consumers can, but countries cannot say this product was made in this wrong way, and so you can only discriminate based on something about the product itself. So they lost the ruling, but the outcome, fortunately for the dolphins, was not that everyone got to have dolphins in their tuna, but rather that the U.S. More or less funded lots of different types of devices for decreasing the number of dolphins which are caught in with the tuna. Of course, some people say, "Well, what about the tuna?" But, of course, the answer to that is, "Well, tuna tastes good." So, it's different. Well, some people say that the tuna doesn't taste as good and now the dolphin's no longer in it. All right. So in this example, the United States had to comply themselves with it. There's not going to be any central authority that's going to force them to do it. Now, the WTO also says, well, if these countries don't comply, then other countries are allowed to do things that they're normally not allowed to do, like put economic sanctions or embargoes or tariffs on certain products. So that was one way in which other states could enforce it, right? That is to say, other states were allowed to do things from normally out of the WTO rules, like put tariffs on imports from the US, so that the punishment is not actually meted out by the organization. It has to be done by individual states.
Okay, is that any states that are in the UN?
WTO, World Trade Organization. I think finally let
I think China just joined.
No, it's Russia. China and Russia both. I think almost everybody's in now. Although the amount, one of the problems is that the amount of domestic enforcement of certain parts of international law with respect to the WTO is pretty highly variable. So international property rights, for example, are not very well respected by China. If you've ever been to Chinatown and picked up some really cheap DVDs, you're aware of this. I mean, it's actually one of the interesting aspects of the international law part of this is that now you have states which aren't really liberal states who are participating in these organizations. Other stuff about classical liberalism? All right. Neoliberalism. Yeah, that's when you're the 800-pound gorilla of international relations, you can afford to have mustaches like that. And not to mention the jacket he's wearing. You can't quite, it's also not good. All right. So the basic premises of neoliberalism or liberal institutionalism, whichever you prefer to call it, cooperation is possible between states. They do not live in an inherently conflictual international system, but that states need help. They need help through cooperation through institutions and organizations. And that, that cooperation depends upon factors other than material power. So most of the analysis at the third level, institutions reduce the uncertainty of intentions. States can signal more readily through international organizations and institutions. And they also decrease transaction costs. So it becomes easier to cooperate, less expensive, less costly in different ways. They also increase the shadow of the future, which is to say that through multiple plays, that the value of the future is more. They ensure that everyone's going to be around and interacting with each other for a much longer time. They also increase transparency. You can see much more easily what other states are doing through sharing of information, monitoring, so on and so forth. Prescriptions, more institutions. Institutions are good. They help us get past all of these different problems. This also relates to things that Oy talks about. Oy also has is a neoliberal perspective. All right. Yeah. Right. Okay. I'm actually playing fast and loose with these slides, the words institutional organization, so let me just clarify that. These particular theorists are not arguing specifically for organizations or institutions per se. But it's an important distinction. The distinction that I would draw is that an organization is a formal organization. It has bureaucrats, it has a budget, it usually has a building of some kind, meetings, rules, decision-making procedures. Institutions more broadly can include things like norms, principles, ideas, things that are informal norms which everyone complies with or thinks one should comply with at least. They don't, you know, just because some people don't comply with it doesn't mean that it's not a norm or an institution. These things can be complementary. The formal organization and the informal and wider institution. Institutions can include organizations. So when we talk about the institution of Reed College, we don't just mean the buildings, budgets, salaries, administrators, and people. We also mean all of the and procedures, right? There are lots and lots of procedures, lots and lots of standard operating procedures. It also means the informal principles, norms, the honor principle, et cetera, that help govern it. So when I write organizations for Doyle and institutions for Cohen, I'm not making a distinction there. It's not that Doyle says we need formal organizations specifically. Yeah, Maddie?
You said that institutions can include more on break.
Yeah.
But on your 2x2 thing,
yes.
Liberalism falls on the side where ideas are not important.
That's right. So, ideas are not, when I say ideas are not important for liberals, what I mean is that ideas are not transformative. That when liberals talk about ideas, it's mostly about sharing information. Norms exist, but liberals have no theory of how norms change over time. Like they're taken for granted in some sense, like interests of states are taken for granted by realists. So this is one area in which you can see complementarity between constructivists and liberal institutionalists, and that constructivists are providing the what are the norms now, how might they change over time, how did they get here, and that liberals will say, given this set of norms, you would probably see more or less cooperation. Make sense? So ideas matter, when I say ideas matter, it's a particular vision or idea of ideas, which is to say that norms can be transformed, change over time, evolve. Not that they are entirely unimportant to liberal institutionalists. Is that answer?
Wait, so you're saying neoliberals take institutions for granted and because of that, norms
can transform? No, because they take it for granted, they have no theory of how norms can change over time.
But your prescription of more institutions can be like more norms, more constructive norms, more liberal norms.
Right, but they don't have a theory of how one comes up with. I mean, it would almost be more organizations. One can formally attempt. I mean, when one formalizes norms into rules, not one ought to, but one must. That's the sort of formalization, and so liberal institutionalists would want to go around creating more rules, and regulations, and procedures for doing things. How you would get about creating new norms is not a question that liberal institutions would be able to answer, at least without, right? I mean, you could combine together accounts, right? A single person could sit down and write an account of how, which we will later, say how the Red Cross was created initially through norm entrepreneurs, and then how it became formalized and how it operates as an organization in order to allow for care in war zones. Okay. I'm drawing an analytical distinction between these people, and as we get into more empirical content, you'll see that people trample all over these distinctions. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't come back to it and answer and ask questions like we did today, about, okay, is this really realism? To a certain extent, it doesn't matter whether it's really realism, unless someone says, this is realism, and realism is better than something else. Is it explaining something? You're like, wait, but that thing which you say realism is better than, you just sort of absorbed it, like Poland. Gotta look out for realists. They're sneaky. Actually, the liberals are really sneaky, too. Cohen, in particular. He's really good at identifying what the new thing is going to be in international relations, and then trying to like sort of swallow the part that he likes of it. So there's, as I mentioned, there's this article on feminism that he wrote. He said, "Well, you know, there's a certain type of feminism, and they're really just liberal institutionalists like us. We should ally." And then there's the postmodernists. I don't like them very much. And then there was the response a couple of years later by Cynthia Weber. Good girls, little girls, and bad girls, which deconstructed Cohen's authorial body. It's quite entertaining. So I recommend it. It's in the extra reading for feminism. All right. So another way of thinking about this is that a lot of these sort of the liberals and the realists tend to be very hegemonic, like to absorb other pieces. All right. Constructivism. So, just briefly mentioning Rousseau. There's Rousseau in A Discourse on the Origin of Inequality. He argues that the state of nature is peaceful and lacks morality. There's no good, there's no bad, there's no stuff. We don't worry about that. That war is created through civilization, not through stealing someone else's stuff. It's not something intrinsic about the law of nature. It is when we have rules, ideas, people getting together, people being social, that you actually get conflict and war. So, in that sense, one can see Rousseau as being, in some sense, a forefather of a lot of constructivist thought. And that it depends upon the social relations. Social relations determine war, not something intrinsic about humans. Prescriptions is that we need social reform, and you also came up with the idea of the general will, if you want to learn about that. Also, tomorrow's class? Rousseau?
No?
Well,
maybe some of them are.
All right. Not liberalism?
Not American Constitution.
Okay, non-American constitutional democracy. Okay, that makes more sense. Okay. Structural constructivism. Alex Wundt. So, basic premises, as he states in his response to Mearsheimer, of course, he has all the same assumptions that Mearsheimer does, including a commitment to third-level theorizing and states as actors, but in addition to that, has some basic premises which more or less apply, I put the premises up here, which apply to all constructivism. The structural pieces, I sliced out. You've already seen those in Mearsheimer. Premises, people act towards other actors on the basis of their understanding of those actors. Collective meaning, also called intersubjective meaning. It's meaning is intersubjective. If I know that you know it, you know that I know it, that we both know it. We both know that we all know it. And that actors acquire relational identities by participating in collective meanings. Okay. Remember back to constructivism, this has to do with the dichotomy between, this is the structure agency, that we as agents all act. In acting, we create structure for others. Others learn from that structure. So we are all collectively acting to create structure, to create relational identities for each other, which we produce and reproduce over time. These identities, then, are the basis of interests. So these interests, which are taken for granted by realists and liberals, are actually constructed, and they're constructed from identities. He then defines an institution as a relatively stable set or structure of identities or and interests. Interest. That should be plural. By the way, there's another typo in these slides. So to keep you awake, I'll keep an eye out for it. Actually, now that I've said that, you'll probably find 5 or 10 of them. There's one which I was aware of as I printed everything out. Self-help is such an institution. That is, self-help is a set or structure of identities and interests. Is not something intrinsic, which you can conclude from Mearsheimer's 5 assumptions. Right? You need to add something to it, which is to say, the culture of anarchy, in order to get to self-help. That we can get out of a self-help world. His analysis is that anarchy is what states make of it. So he specifies 3 different anarchies. There's the competitive anarchy, which is the Hobbesian anarchy. We've read Hobbes, or went over Hobbes, the individualistic anarchy, the Lockean anarchy. And then finally, the cooperative anarchy, which is the Kantian version of it. The prescription is that states should act based on how their actions reinforce structures. So if you want to have others treat you in a peaceful way, you need to act peacefully towards them. You can create Kantian anarchies, sub-anarchies in certain parts of the international system. So some people argue, for example, that Europe has a different type of anarchy than the rest of the world does. Right? They've managed to get to a Kantian anarchy through institutions, through creating structures, through acting towards each other in a very consistent way, such that they all consider themselves to be friends, except for Greece.
Maybe.
Sorry?
Maybe. And
maybe Italy, and maybe Portugal, and we don't, well, anyway. So, of course, one also has to keep in mind that this particular institution of interest came after 2 really, really, really bloody wars. So, there may need to be a process, a historical institutional process through which one gets into Kantian anarchy. All right. Yes, really. So, treating each other as ethical objects could be one way in which you would create and recreate a structure of interaction. And in some ways, Doyle's liberalism, classical liberalism, is in some ways is normative. Not in the sense of one should, but that it's a description. So Doyle's describing what a liberal state looks like. And a liberal state is one in which people treat each other as ethical objects. He's not explaining how do you get to a liberal state. He's saying once you get to a state in which people treat each other as ethical objects, then you end up having these norms with respect to each other, which you then externalize with respect to other states. But Doyle doesn't have a theory by which you get there. Okay. Kant sort of has this problem as well. He doesn't quite have a theory of how you manage to get to this lovely state, except that, you know, somehow you have individual states who have republican constitutions who join together over time. So you can think of this in terms of the readings we have for today and the end of the Cold War, is that realism did not have a very good theory for ending the Cold War, in part because realism doesn't deal with change. Especially structuralism doesn't deal with change very well. And ideas about others. So when we stop thinking, when we stop acting towards each other as if there was a Cold War going on, the Cold War ended. Right? It's a very parsimonious constructivist explanation of how did the Cold War end? Well, you had norm entrepreneurs, Gorbachev, and you had others who were open to that, Reagan, and once they decided to stop treating each other as enemies and instead as something more peaceful, Cold War ends. Okay. Now you don't have to buy that explanation, but it is an explanation which allows you to posit change through norm entrepreneurs. Other questions? Nope. Looking good? All right. Feminism. So, Tichenor, since the Carpenter and Schoberg readings are mostly literature reviews of some kind, they don't really have a positive theories. I'm mostly going to refer to Tichenor as far as feminism goes in the premises. So, although she constructed these premises as a way of refuting or overturning Morgenthau's, these still are perspectives which are all compatible with and most feminist theory. So, dynamic objectivity, the world is not separate, it is affected by our lenses, particularly gendered lenses which we have. That language and values contain gendered assumptions. So her analysis, and her response to Morgenthau, is that the first level is that human nature doesn't lead to a will to power. It's not automatic that humans want power. Rather, that's a gendered assumption. Men want power. And that power we can instead redefine power itself. Right? Instead of thinking of power as domination of men over men, we can think of power as in terms of getting things done. So that's the first level. At the third level, I can say that states in weak positions build coalitions rather than balance, and they achieve cooperative solutions. That all of this focus in realism is almost exclusively on interactions between great powers. Michael, is that a question or a stretch? Go ahead. Intentions matter. That they are, in fact, a guide to how states act, and they should be used as a guide to how both individuals and states act. Yeah.
So intentions matter for everything but realism, right? Realism, more than that, is the one is like intentions are irrelevant to all the capabilities, and everybody else kind of like all know, like intentions play some part in the realism.
I think there's some game theoretical accounts that don't really, in which intentions go out the window as well, in that when you're within a certain payoff structure, right, it's not what you intend, it's just how you're essentially stuck in this particular payoff structure and how everyone's going to act. One of the solutions to getting out of certain things like prisoner's dilemmas could be something like intentions, I suppose. But it's not a necessary part of the analysis. You can throw out intentions, put actors into a structure, and they will reliably act in certain ways. So I would say that the more abstract theories also do not require intentions or do not include it. Yeah, Darcy.
Right.
So, where is feminism in the 2x2? Most of feminism is in critical theory, because most of it involves identifying gendered notions and assumptions and values. Not all of it. Some of them are about the change in gender norms over time, studying that. Schoberg says you could have something like a feminist realism. Not exactly sure how that would work. But she says you can. Cohen argues that certain types of feminism are compatible with liberalism, and that there's this sort of idea of collective empowerment is at least compatible with or not incompatible with liberal notions of cooperation. So you could have a feminist analysis of those things. I think but in terms of where most feminist work falls, most of it's in critical theory. And most of the stuff we've read has been in critical theory. Right? Cohn is pointing out the language, how the particular language that strategists use is gendered and abstract. And she's also causal in some sense, right? This is the other constitutive causal, in that by abstracting and by having this gendered language, you end up with making it possible to think about in their, nuclear war. Wilcox, is showing how is it possible, or even how it, how gender assumptions lean towards a cult of the offensive. Okay. So I don't want you to think of critical theory exclusively as a tearing things apart and deconstruction. That's a very particular type of critical theory. That's the Derridean political theory, which I derided today in at least one section. Not all critical theory is this sort of postmodernist deconstructionist. Many of the critical theory which points out these dichotomies does contain within it, explicitly or implicitly, prescriptions. Right? Stop distancing language. Once you become aware of existing structures and values, that makes it possible to change them. Right? So the first step of changing norms is realizing that a thing is a norm and something out there and not a taken for granted. If you take it for granted, you never think about it and things aren't going to change. But if you start considering it to be, oh, wait, that's just how we do things, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way, that then opens up the possibility for normative change over time. Okay. Yeah? Unfortunately, the way that I would define critical theory is that it critiques other things, and so it's more of a negative definition than a positive definition. There are some things that characterize most critical theorists. One of it being that their methodology usually is pointing out these taken for granted assumptions about the world. Most of the assumptions which they attempt to demonstrate have to do with power. How power is embedded in and how we are controlled by, constrained by language and how we think about things. Most of them are post-positivist, if not post-modernist. In fact, all of them are post-positivist. Not all of them are post-modernist, in that some critical theorists think that you can apply things from one case to other cases. That's one of the defining features of being really post-modern. You just study one thing in its unique, you know, in its unique environment, and that there's nothing you can do about this other thing over here. But that's a very small, particular group within critical theory. So, exposing power, demonstrating that that taking for granted assumptions are actually embedded in power relationships, focus on language and linguistic constructs. I think that's the best. I'm not a critical theorist. I mean, I'm a big fan of it because it's a lot of fun, but, you know. Yeah, what's a self-fulfilling prophecy? Realism. Yeah, critical theorists would definitely say that realism is a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, so would many constructors. Like Wendt says it as well, but he's not a critical theorist. Instead, he is pointing out that it's simply this normative structure. Now, Wendt would argue you can get out of that normative structure, right? You can move from one culture again to a different, nicer culture again. Critical theorists might be a little more skeptical about the niceness of other cultures in anarchy. In fact, what I would say that where Wendt probably makes a misstep is in arguing that other cultures of anarchy, that the one we're in is the nastiest we could possibly be in. You could argue that we could be in even nastier culture of anarchy, as seen by many post-apocalyptic movies. Right? Post-apocalyptic movies, it really is a war of all against all. You have Blade Runner. Actually, Blade Runner's not too bad. what am I thinking? Road Warrior, thank you. In which it's beyond anarchy as Hobbes described it. It's not just a war of all against all in which war could break out at any time, but that there is constant conflict. Yeah? Sorry? No.
Is there any critical theory that isn't feminist?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Most of it. The reason why I'm giving you feminist critical theory is because it's more well established in IR than most other critical theory is, and it's more accessible. And that once the gender dichotomies are pointed out, they're out of the boat. And they tend to write more clearly. A lot of critical theory is. So if you look at, Wendt cites a number of different types of critical theorists, and there's some neo-Marxists in there too, who are also materialists and screw up my whole 2x2, so we won't talk about them. There is other critical theory out there, but feminism is the most mainstream, relatable.
Or credible.
Sorry? In the study of international politics. Which isn't to say that gender dichotomies are the main thing which necessarily characterize all international politics. It's just that people who write in the feminist tradition have gotten more leverage into the discipline, into the subfield itself. You can also start thinking about meta problems like the international politics of international politics and whether we're really in anarchy and power and all these other things, and then you just end up in this downward self-referential spiral. So don't go there. Spencer?
You said that critical theory is post-positivist. We never really got a definition
of positivism. Positivism is essentially based on the same sort of falsificationist idea. Popper is sort of... I mean, even Popper is a little post-positivist. Positivism makes some stronger assumptions about the world, right? So Morgenthau is more or less a positivist. He's sort of the only straight-up positive, right? The world is objective. It is out there. We have access to it through our theories. We can construct a rational theory of things. Post-positivism says, well, the world's not really objective. It's kind of subjective, and the lenses that we use cloud it, and that we don't have direct access to it, but we can still falsify things. So that's sort of the thing which it has in common. Yes, we recognize there are all these various problems, but we should still keep doing all the things we've been doing before. We'll just keep falsifying things. We'll just admit that things are constructed and keep going. There are entire textbooks written on philosophy of science and international relations, and if you're into that kind of thing, I can point you in that direction. It is kind of a rabbit hole, though. You don't really want to... I don't recommend it. Unless you want to write a political theory, international relations thesis of some kind, and be the next Kenneth Waltz, Man, the State, and War. But hopefully yours won't be Man, the State, and War. Now that I've taught you all feminism.
So you're saying then that all these others, you know, liberals and constructivists and so on, are post-positivists?
Yeah, they generally admit that we don't have, that they don't rely on or assume the same sort of access to the world. That the world doesn't, the world is completely unchangeable. Some of them are a little stronger, like Mearsheimer basically says, I mean, he more or less says in his debate with you know, argument one, he's like, well, all right, maybe it is a social construct. It's a really, realism is a really stable social construct, but it's a social construct. That's fine. Doesn't really bother him. 700 years, pretty good, or 3,000 years, or however many years that realists are claiming these days. It's a pretty good track record, so.
So they said because the world is not completely unchangeable, and therefore positivism isn't entirely unchangeable.
Right, so there's a number of assumptions of positivism, right, which include objective world, unfiltered access to it, and that we can construct theories, which accurately represent and refer to things out in that.
And even structural realists are at this level? Even classical realists are at this?
I mean, they sort of fall across the spectrum, but Morgenthau, I think, is really the ideal type. Right, I mean, physicists threw out this whole idea of objective reality, which we are separate from it, when they discovered quantum mechanics, and we're just like, well, our observations change reality. Oh, well. And then they just kind of went on doing whatever they were doing. So it's taken a while for social science to catch up with where physical science has actually been for quite a long time. Although even some physical scientists never quite wrap their heads around or admit it, the full implications of quantum mechanics either. Okay, good. Let's see, did we finish feminism? We've mostly finished feminism. Right. Oh, yeah. So you get coalitions, you achieve cooperative solutions. They're not ignored. Like feminist theory and other types of theories do not ignore states if they're not great powers. And that through common, we can find common moral elements. These sort of moral sentiments, which Morgenthau throws out as being useless and pointless and not a good guide to anything, just lead you down the road to perdition in which you will not properly balance against states that rhyme with ermine. Quickly enough, he said in that, Tigran says, no, actually these common, we actually do have common moral sentiments, so these common moral sentiments can lead us to cooperation and de-escalate conflict. And we should band together to solve our pressing collective world problems, nuclear disarmament, environmental problems, so on and so forth. If you think conflict is depressing, wait till we get to the environment. That's the end of class. And this is an entire course in that, international environmental politics. All right. I'm going to go relatively quickly through these comparison points, since some of you look like you're about to fall asleep. That's better, Marcus. Plus, we've been over some of these before, directly or indirectly in class, and they may be somewhat less relevant for your essay, nonetheless. All right, so, Jervis, the original title of his piece, as I think I mentioned, is Cooperation Under the Security Dilemma. It was actually changed for the excerpted version which we read, but the premise remains the same, is that it is possible to get to this completely unreadable, well, you know, this doubly stable. It's the good box, this one's the bad one. Doubly dangerous, doubly stable. Security dilemma in the upper half, no security dilemma in the lower half, direct is possible when offense has the advantage. We've gone through this a few times. All right. So premises is that the security dilemma prevents cooperation, and that the offense-defense advantage, and that differentiation between different types of technologies can affect exactly how bad the world is. A little or cooperation you get. Analysis on the third level is that differentiation can eliminate the security dilemma, and the defensive advantages committing it to security of the law. Right? So it's he's assuming here, now this isn't a necessary part of the analysis. You could apply differentiation, you could apply defensive or offensive advantage to interaction between states, you could apply to, as opposed to being at the completely at the structural level. But you could apply that in your number of analysis, and you may have to, because defensive and offensive advantage may depend heavily on things like terrain and differential levels of technology between different types of states. Who has the latest stuff? So the prescriptions are pretty clear. You know that wherever possible, you should get defensive weapons because that doesn't. If the weapons are differentiable and you can look at them and say, wow, that's defensive, then that's not going to cause a security dilemma between you and whatever states you're interacting with. Oi. Takes a neoliberal. So the idea is that it's still possible to get to cooperation, which is to say lack of conflict in a realist world, as long as you're under certain conditions. Now, there are certain behaviors which you can adopt in order to further that. So Jervis is known as a defensive realist. Oi argues, of course, comes from a neoliberal perspective, and so he doesn't assume that we live in a zero-sum world, that countries and individuals and whoever can potentially get to cooperation. It's absolute, not relative gains. And that by changing the structure of the payoffs, the shadow of the future, the number of players, that you can increase the likelihood of cooperation. So decreasing the number of players, changing the structure of the payoffs, that no one has an incentive to defect from pure cooperation, that's changing prisoners' dilemmas into stag hunts, increasing the shadow of the future, having multiple plays to go along. So analysis on the third level. So payoff structures can be changed through a number of different techniques, publicizing agreements, buying defensive weapons, right? There's actually some sort of, there's some overlap here, having hostages. Shadow of the future, as I mentioned in class, is useful for prisoner's dilemma, it's useful for stag hunt, is not useful for chicken because you want to develop a reputation for not swerving in chicken. I already told you how to win chicken with beer bottles and steering wheels, so always keep an extra one in your car just in case you're facing off with someone else. Make sure they're not also from this class, though. Chicken, when playing chicken, you want to commit to not swerving. Two ways of doing that. One is that you demonstrate that you are intoxicated by taking a bunch of beer bottles and throwing them out the window. It tells your opponent that you may not be rational anymore, right? Consider this with respect to threats and promises. And so therefore you're not going to swerve. Because as a rational person, the other way to do it is by demonstrating you've lost control of your car. You do that by throwing your steering wheel out the window. Right? And therefore, if you're throwing your steering wheel out the window, you can no longer swerve. But the other person has to swerve. Well, now that I've told you my tricks, you will no longer be deterred by the beer bottles and the extra steering wheel that keep in my car. Of course, the disadvantage is that if you get pulled over by a cop, then you may have some questions to answer. Sure. I'll go with that. Reciprocal strategies also help tip for tat. So if I announce my strategy, say, if you cooperate this round, I will cooperate next round. Or whatever you do this round, I will do the next round. That actually helps to solve certain things, including chicken. Helps for all of them. You can also have regimes. Regimes being a fancy word for institutions. Linkage, issue linkage, tying together different types of issues so we can all get to a better situation. And decomposition over time. Instead of just doing things as a one-shot, do it through a series of transactions. I can link them in the shadow of the future. With respect to number of players, you can decrease transaction costs and... But what was I thinking when I wrote that? Transaction costs, yes. Okay, transaction costs, you can decrease them through regimes. Oh, numbers of players increases transaction costs. This is the problem with putting everything in shorthand. You can sometimes not remember what some of the things means. If you have more players, that increases transaction costs, increases the probability of autonomous defection. The more people that you need to catch the stag, the more likely it is that one of them is going to defect, etc., etc. Okay. Let's see. Sanctioning and monitoring abilities decrease. So if you manage to create institutions or regimes, ways of coming up with standardized monitoring to see what everyone's going to do and to sanction people if they do the wrong thing, and that helps to improve cooperation. Prescriptions, alter structures, increase the shadow of the future, decrease players. Alright. Balancing and bandwagoning. Walt versus Schweller. So, Walt argues you balance versus threats, not power. Schweller argues that actually it's about interest, not about threat. That many states will bandwagon for profit, and it's not just with respect to whatever the most threatening thing is. So, analysis that Walt argues that is a third level analysis, that bandwagoning, if they're relatively weak compared to the other states, so this is the interaction level, not all the way up to structural, because it's just vis-a-vis whoever it is that you're considering directly. You'll also bandwagon if your geography is bad and therefore allies are not available. And bandwagoning can also increase in the end stages of the war. Almost all other cases, you'll see balancing. He did this, by the way, empirically in his study Origins of Alliances with Middle Eastern Alliances. So if you're interested in Middle Eastern Alliances, it's a good book to check out. Prescriptions is that, well, it's better to balance than bandwagon in most circumstances. It's only under certain rare circumstances that you should actually bandwagon. Schweller, by contrast, argues that you should look at interests instead of threats. That his analysis, he's got at both at the second level and the third level of analysis. On the second level of analysis, of course, he has his nice animal typology, wolves and jackals, large revisionists will bandwagon, lions and lambs. Well, our status quo, and will generally balance. Although, well, the jackal will sometimes bandwagon with lions at the end of wars. He specifies different types of bandwagoning at the end of war, wave of the future, contagion. He also argues that the overall amount of war which you're going to see in the system is going to vary on the distribution of these types of states across the entire system. Okay, he doesn't specify how that's going to happen, although he does say, he does actually say that after a really particularly bloody war, you're going to have more status quo states. So he does have one mechanism for that, the overall distribution. So prescriptions, bandwagon whenever it's profitable and whenever your security isn't threatened. Yeah, Nadia.
Does it make more sense to bandwagon when your security is threatened by the counterpower?
Right. If your security is threatened, then you should also bandwagon. This is his additional prescription on top of the Walt. He agrees with Walt that when your security is threatened, that's a good time to bandwagon. But the additional thing is that if your security isn't threatened, then there are these additional conditions which you would also bandwagon if it just happens to be profitable.
Didn't he also say that if you try to bandwagon a really powerful state, they might turn around on you and you can't trust them?
I'm not remembering that precise phrase, although that certainly sounds logical. Jackals have to beware following wolves or something. I mean, it is. I mean, it's an argument made by Walt as well. Is that you need to be worried? That states are always worried about the state that they're bandwagoning with, that they're threatened by. And as soon as the pressure's off, that they'll leave. But the threatening state. Has no particular interest in keeping you around. You're much more valuable to the balancing coalition than to the bandwagoning coalition. So, I'd say it probably applies for both of them. Schweller's just probably a little too caught up in his animal metaphors, thinking about wolves and coyotes or something. All right, democratic peace. Doyle versus Rosato. So, I think we more or less did.
Yep.
did all that.
So this is just a repeat of the earlier premises and analysis and prescriptions. Rosato, by contrast, argues that democracies must externalize norms and be accountable in order to be peaceful, and that they neither externalize their norms nor are they accountable. Externalization hasn't happened, looks at imperial wars, Cold War interventions, and great power rivalries, in which they have treated each other in nasty ways instead of externalizing sort of this rule of law which you're supposed to apply to other democratic states, and that there's a lack of accountability, that Democrats don't lose power after losing wars, constraints don't operate domestically most of the time, democracies can mobilize quickly and conduct surprise attacks, and don't actually give off useful information. So all of the five mechanisms which democratic peace theory, we only read the Doyle's version of democratic peace theory, we haven't read the rest of the best of them, but Rosato more or less goes over them and then goes and debunks each one of them. Hopefully that was fairly straightforward. And prescriptions, of course, are that the U.S. probably shouldn't continue to promote democracy, at least shouldn't continue to promote democracy in an offensive manner. It's not a bad thing, but it's not something which the U.S. should have a particular interest in for the purposes of not going to war with other countries. That the democratic peace really just doesn't exist. They might want it for other reasons, but it should not be an overriding reason. Yeah. Yeah. No, he doesn't mean in the U.S. He's not arguing that the U.S. should be an autocracy. Nor does he argue that corporations are people. All right, Allison, which I've classified as a debate because he's sort of arguing with himself. Three different models: classical realist model, hopefully you're all familiar with, organizational process model, and a bureaucratic policy model. Each one at a slightly different level of analysis, although, of course, there's overlap between them. Classical realism being the basic premise that states are rational unitary actors. Analysis sort of at third level, although this is before neorealism was invented, so he's not really a structural realist, but he more or less says that optimal decisions are made for security by states. The organizational process model: government is a group of organizations. They have standard operating procedures with inputs and outputs. Take those inputs, produce those outputs, often in a pathological manner. These are based on these are good for the organization, but end up constraining decision making in various ways, either through limiting the number of different types of policy options or by limiting the amount of information and when the information comes in. Bureaucratic policy model: government is a group of interested individuals in particular positions. And so it's first level, it's also second level. Decisions are made based on bargaining games between individuals with different levels of power and different positions with different psychologies. For the different positions, it's more the organizational level of analysis, this is where you stand, where you sit, but and it's the psychologies of the individuals that end up having that have an effect as well. So it's sort of a two-level thing, which is both of which are expressed through the chiefs in each particular bureau. You all are looking tired. All right, last slide. Lebeau, psychology. I decided to throw this in at the last minute because, well, we did cover it as a theory, and some of you might be so sufficiently excited about psychology and psychological theory that you might want to try to put it in your essays, so I thought I would include it. All right, so basically two different types of biases: cognitive biases from Burris's work, and motivational biases from Janis and Mann, which, of course, the cognitive biases are what you expect to see. Analysis is that historical or personal images, this is Jervis's sort of summarizing it, lead to incorrect attribution, premature closure, perceptual satisficing, masking, insensitivity, belief system overkill, and rationalization. There's a number of different processes through which these images end up affecting what it is that you expect to see things, and then you see them. And the motivated biases, the Janis and Mann, with that excellent flowchart through which you can see all the various different ways in which you can make pathological decisions based on seeing what you want to see. So if the risks are low, you either get unconflicted adherence or change, depending upon whether you get information about your decision that indicates that what you were doing, the risk is low, or that this new alternative, the risk is low in that. If, on the other hand, you can't hope to solve the problem, then you end up having defensive avoidance or hypervigilance. And those two categories, depending upon whether you either can't hope to solve the problem or don't have time to solve the problem. Okay. Questions? I would find it difficult to apply psychological decision-making mechanisms to anything other than individuals. In that it's difficult. Well, you can, but these psychological theories aren't going to give you a real grasp on that. In that.
So that's getting more like.
Right. You want well? I mean, there are social psychological theories. Which are going to come into play then, but we just haven't studied the social psychological theories, things like groupthink. If you want to talk about, I mean, we often speak of countries as if they were people, in terms of misperception or bias, but often that's more sort of a shorthand, whoops. There we go. Often that's... Often that is shorthand for individual decision makers and leaders. And if you're talking about, say, images which countries have of each other or roles, which can be inferred sometimes through actions or patterns or references made by individuals, that is to say, there are intersubjective ideas which countries have about each other by virtue of interaction, right? It's based in individuals, it's sitting in individuals' brains, but because we have this intersubjective collective, because we have these collective ideas, we can then speak of countries as if they saw each other in certain ways. But these sort of cognitive biases, are you thinking of, that a country has an image of another country from a historical, due to a historical thing, that would that then affect all of the decision makers in that country?
Well, a concern having with the speaker is that a lot of news articles, especially when they deal with, like, ground troops in different countries, talk about, like, this battalion of Marines has this image of the Taliban. Or, they have this image of the, Afghan national security. So, it's confusing to think about what level of analysis is that. Like, is that, organizational? Is that individuals?
Well, it depends upon what the causal statement is then after that. Mm-hmm. That they have this image, and so the question is, do you want to then talk about processes of rationalization, processes in which decisions are cut short, all these various different types of biases, either cognitive or motivated, or whether you want to talk, or whether it then goes on to say that Marines, that some set of Marines has this view of the Taliban, and that is because of the interaction between them and the Taliban that you end up with creating and reinforcing identities. Because that's an interaction, that would be more in sort of constructivist theory.
Okay.
But if you have evidence, this is the important thing, where's the evidence, what's the evidence going to look like? Mm-hmm. It's like a lot of the ones you want evidence that the processes which are occurring are present. You need quotes from people in which they're doing things or saying things which indicate a particular type of bias. You can't assert that the bias exists, you need to show it. Same thing with the identities. You need to make an argument for that how these different types of identities and how these agents interact with each other reinforce those identities.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, this is the thing. With constructivism with psychology, the evidence standards are kind of higher in some sense, which is unfair. And that the realist evidence standards tend to be kind of low. I mean, the analogy that I usually like to make is that, you know, realism is, if you're trying to get somewhere where realism is a Jeep, it's basic, it's not very, it's utilitarian, it's not very comfortable, but it gets you there. And liberalism is like a Lexus, and it's really comfortable, and you like hang out in it, but it's not going to go on all the roads that realism can go over. Constructivism is like a helicopter. You can see everything that's going on, and most of you have no business trying to pilot a helicopter. Like, take lessons first or something. So sort of work your way up to it. It's not true in all cases. If you're specifically dealing with something in which clearly identities are irrelevant or important, religious schisms, or views of, or where the people in newspaper articles say things like, we are French, or we are European, or, you know, why are we giving money to Greece? We're giving it because of World War II. Right, then the identities are sort of jumping off the page. And in those cases, it's good to do that. But the problem can often come in which one is imputing identities onto actors based on their actions and not based on some sort of deeper evidence. Right, the Marines shot at the Taliban, so they must have this sort of view or identity vis-a-vis them. Well, you know, how do you know?
Yeah.
But if the Marines are quoted saying certain things, then you have some specific evidence to demonstrate that there's a relationship between the actions and the identities.
Okay.
You all want to fly choppers, don't you? Mm-hmm. All right. Marcus, have you given up? Is that a Phoenix?
Yeah.
Psychology, right. Psychology, this is like psychology and organizations and institutional theory and bureaucratic processes. All of these can be compatible with different types of things depending upon if you are arguing for sort of a rational material actor basis or whether you are arguing for, they sort of slot into a lot of perspectives. So you can combine psychology and realism and structural realism in saying that if leaders in certain countries are more likely to suffer from motivated biases, those countries are going to be eliminated from the system.
So you would never really say, like, the
I mean, you could, but it's not a. It's generally not a competing theory. Like it's a micro theory, right? We have micro theories about how individuals interact with each other, and theories of individual action. So to that extent, it's competing in that we have different theories. We have rational theories of individual action, which individuals are trying to optimize for some utility, or you have the logic of consequences, or you have the logic of appropriateness, like who am I and what should I be doing at this particular point. Then you have the psychological model of action, which is that we have all these shortcuts and heuristics and sort of blockages which limit our rationality. That doesn't necessarily override any particular model. You could have, it could be very compatible with the sort of ideas about, with a constructivist logic of appropriateness, identities, ideas, or it can be compatible with the rationalist model, except that it just says that rationality is very limited. It cuts down on it. In the same way that standard operating procedures limit rationality, psychological models say rationality is limited. It doesn't say it's not there. So it's a part of a theory rather than being a theory of everything. Just like standard operating procedures don't explain international relations, but when you sort of combine them in a chain with other things, you can explain, in order to explain individual phenomena. Marcus? No? Okay. That was a stretch? Okay. Maya?
I think that's a little while. When it comes to bipolarity, why exactly is bipolarity
Right, okay, so at least in the Waltzian definition, it's simpler, it's easier, calculations are easy to make, you don't have as much uncertainty. The number of dyads with whom could have conflict is much smaller, it's only one. But if you have five great powers, it could be any of them that get into a conflict with each other. And so it's just sort of like the system is much simpler. You know, it's more stable, it's more reliable. There are some particular things about coalitions also that make, like, which coalition do I join is easier in the bipolar world than it is in the multipolar world, especially if there are multiple coalitions. Do I need to swing this way or that way? Most countries, so Waltz argues that countries will, that balancing is easier, that they'll be welcomed on the weaker side. And that's obvious, but that the overall balance of power isn't thrown off very much in a bipolar system by these little powers joining one side or the other. So in a multipolar system, somebody swings, then you get big effects. Somebody moves from one part of the bipolar world to the other part, still bipolar. Well, the institutionalism is trying to extract countries from certain aspects of anarchy, really. Right? It's making it such that you no longer, like in a world in which, say, you have multiple powers, that you can, that you sort of these calculations which you need to make, the intentions are clearer, action is clearer, people are more likely to be caught, it defines things better. So due to this more information, you have less conflict over. It's not trying to recreate a bipolar structure. In fact, there are arguments made that if you have a rigid bipolar alliance structure, then you will lead to war. You need the flexibility of being able to move back and forth. So one of the arguments for the cause of World War I is that the alliance structure was rigid and could not accommodate any shifts in power, which then led for a coalition to get slightly ahead and decide to go for it. All right, you can go. If anyone has individual questions, you're welcome to stick around. This?
Yeah.
Can I ask a question specifically with regard to